Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourselves up. I told you that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry and put that pools in your money and hold that money and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know, you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't, lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope. Afraid of change? You can't do anything about it. Change is inevitable. Growth is the great fundamental principle, the function of our lives. The seed in the ground will rot if it does not sprout and grow. And so will our minds and souls and bodies. Without conscious action and striving, our Creator answers most prayers in the terms of ideas for action. He doesn't give us something for nothing. He expects us to use what He gives us in active exercise of a freedom which He permits our minds and souls to exercise in reactions to the life patterns of ups and downs, strange events, curious, unforeseen happenings. Human consistencies, all can be changed according to the way our mind evolves, adapts, and grows. Nothing in this world is so inevitable, nor hardly so obvious. The fact is, everything does change. So often we'd like things to remain the same. It'd be so comfortable, nice. We get used to things. We adapt ourselves to a certain pattern. And then suddenly, without any warning, it changes. What are you going to do about it? Well, the first step in gaining a happier and more satisfying state of mind is recognition of the significance of this fact. Everything changes. Everything in life is changing as you and I are changing. And we must do more than this to take proper advantage of the ceaseless change inevitable in our lives. We must consciously react to direct actions that change in the paths of improvement, in the growth of our mind and soul. Change alone is inevitable and constant. But change alone is not growth. It is not progress. We have to do the progress ourselves. We have to convert. We have to adapt. Growth is a cornerstone, the primary marvel of our earthly lives. Our Creator has provided for physical growth in a pattern in which He has given us only limited powers to alter. From babyhood, we go to childhood, from childhood to adolescence, from adolescence to adulthood. And so the story grows. Physical growth. But the way we adapt ourselves to prepare ourselves for those unusual situations, the ones which we can call pleasant or unpleasant, that depends on the way we grow in our minds, the way we grow in the power of adaptation. For friends, life is a constant adaptation. Every phase of life presents a spectacle of change. And as a consequence, the spectacle of retrogression, a standstill status or progress of growth. In each case of progress or growth, there is a constant overcoming, a vanquishment of the obstacles met in the Creator's pattern of constant change. See, that's all important. All about us, we see growth or deterioration taking place in grass, in flowers, in vegetables, in pets, in our children, in our own body. But the thing that's important is the way we adapt ourselves to this change. That's all important. In our affairs, all too often, we select for cultivation the very things we don't want. Courses that lead to mistakes and trouble, sorrow and pain. Then we carefully endow these selections with the full energy of our thoughts and words. We water them with tears and self-pity. Give them the concentration of undivided attention. And then we have a way of wondering why, indeed of all our efforts, we grow in a crop of trouble and discord. Let me tell you, it is not necessary. Let us deliberately refuse to turn our thoughts to those weeds we do not want. We must discipline our minds to concentrate on the good, on positive thoughts, the sunshine and water and soil that produce good in our lives, on the thought energy, the emotional powers we concentrate on our affairs to convert inevitable change into growth. In other words, our job every single day, and this day too, is to watch where we're going, what we're doing. If we want love and happiness, be sure it's to love and happiness that you devote your attention, not to discord and bitterness and resentment. If you want success in some field, give full recognition. Yes, give full recognition to success. And it's yours already. Think positive thoughts. Fix the life-giving force of your attentions and assurance and faith on the good you already have. Look for it in every circumstance. Now make no mistake about it. Change is inevitable. You can't halt the process of change any more than you can keep your child a baby. In the words of Dr. Arthur H. Compton, everywhere the conditions of life are changing rapidly, and these changes are all in the direction of greater interdependence. That is, making better cooperation of paramount importance. The point is that in this process of change, we go forward or we go backward. We bow to circumstances or we rise above circumstances. Of course, we cannot be expected to see beyond the point of our understanding. any more than we can see beyond the horizon limit of our eyes. But the point is, we can master the thoughts we permit to remain in our minds. We can choose our thoughts according to God's laws. We know we get out of life exactly what we put into it. Nothing more, nothing less. We know if we sow love, we shall reap love. We sow hate, we reap hate. We have the power to concentrate on whatever kind of thoughts we choose. We know that if we endeavor to have an understanding heart, we shall find elsewhere an understanding heart. We know if we pardon, we shall be pardoned. We know if we give, we shall receive. Look at your own picture, 5, 10, or 20 years ago. See what a change has been made on the outside, in the outside person. You will scarcely know yourself. Well, that's the growth of the body. But God has given you the mastery of your mind. Your soul can keep pace with the growth of the body. Just as the less perceptible growth of the trunk of the tree matches the more visible enlargement of its limbs. Look back at what you were thinking 5, 10, or 20 years ago, at the obstacles which seemed insurmountable then, at the joys and sorrows of yesterday. And just as it's hard to believe, those old photographs are you. Yes, we really looked as we did, not as we see ourselves in the mirror today. So it is equally difficult to imagine the progress, the maturity, that our soul has accomplished and made in the course of these years. In other words, we do not change without more than we change within. This is all important to know. There is no limit to the transformation which can take place in your mind. When we dig a little deeper in our search for answers to life's questions, when we wisely read between the lines, we find that God puts his blessings upon our efforts and draws us close, imparts to us his divine wisdom. We find, first of all, that our soul, our mind, gains maturity as we react in a positive manner to the pattern of life, no matter how unpleasant or unexpected. A pattern which we may not be able to change, except in our minds. But remember, that's all important in our mind, because what actually counts is what we think, the way we feel about something. The growth of the soul, therefore, depends upon our free reaction to the problems with which we are faced. Our life is part of a divine plan, carefully prepared in every detail. Each moment of that plan offers a marvelous opportunity for our adaptation, for the growth of our soul and of our mind. The whole picture of our lives is so much brighter than the small pieces that hold and which our minds are prone to dwell on at length. Isolated from the background of all this, the whole, some parts, may look awfully black. But let me tell you, our Creator, in time, ultimately moves in on our subconscious mind and plays a pleasant trick on all of us. The unpleasant experiences of the past are relegated to the past. When we realize the power of our mind, the real secret escapes us as long as we fail to exercise that freedom of choice, all important, endowed to us by our Creator. This mystery of growth functions in time of crises more than ever before. We say, why does this happen to me? How could this happen to me? I don't deserve this. Suppose we say, this is an opportunity, a challenge to react and gain greater maturity. Life with its steady, compelling urge to grow means that any door may open to us at any moment. Life makes us beneficiary of the physical experiences that the ages have bequeathed to us, of the signs and inventions of genius, of the mental and physical work of our forefathers that set us free to seek the larger spiritual things of life. Friends, let us profit by these examples of the past, by physical knowledge, to prepare ourselves better for the experiences of life. Yes, we can encounter experiences of all kinds along life's highway, good and bad, pleasant and unpleasant. We can prepare ourselves for many trials simply through the richness of knowledge of those who lived before us. But along that same highway, Each of us is certain to meet some experiences so different from those for which we are prepared and so unexpected. But the point is, are they going to catch us unprepared and unawares? Each of us on life's journey must face a great many such surprising and disconcerting experiences that happen every day, any minute, and take us unprepared, unaware. The knowledge that somehow or other we have inside of us the strength, the power, and mastery of our mind to control every situation, to react, and so to change in our mind our feelings about any problem and situation is all important. What a wonderful privilege is ours to be a human being, to know that we endow with the mastery of our mind, that we can control through our reactions whatever is our fate. No, we may not control circumstances or situations, but we can control our life because we control that which we feel about life. What a wonderful challenge it is. Friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you, everyone.
Listen to me. Rich people think differently. So what I'm going to put in your head today is a rich people concept so you can get to understand it. The only difference between successful people and not is just how they think. Rich people think different. Quit letting people tell you you got to get qualified in another program. You don't need another program to be successful. You need to change the way you think. So here's the deal. The problem with becoming a millionaire is that when you decide that you want to be a millionaire, you immediately start thinking, how can I become a millionaire? Well, that thought don't just pop into your head, so you get frustrated and you don't become a millionaire. And you start creating stuff like, well, I guess this wasn't the Lord's will, or as soon as I think of how I'm going to make a million. You can't think of how to make $1 million. Stop. Do you know if you knew how to make $1 million, what's the day, Tuesday? Wouldn't you make it by Friday? Would not you make it by Friday? But suppose I told you how you can become a millionaire with what you have. Because here's the deal. All of you have everything it takes to become rich. You just don't believe it. Now, if you can develop this theory that I'm about to share with you, I have the way for you to be rich. This is it. First of all of you have a gift. God gave it to you when he created you. God never created a single soul without giving them a gift. That's the God that created you. He's a very smart God. Here's the cold thing. When he made you, he put the gift inside of you. He didn't hide it under the ocean. It ain't on the mountain nowhere. It ain't under no rocks. You ain't got to go drilling. God put what you needed inside of you at birth. All of you have a gift. But you have got to do your gift, the thing God gave you at birth to do. It is the thing that you do the absolute best with the least amount of effort. That's your gift. Anything else you doing, you wasting your time. Do you hear me? You wasting your time. If when the alarm clock goes off in the morning and it makes you sick every morning that alarm go off, it's because you ain't doing your gift. You're going against what God created you to be. Do most of you know what your gift is? Who in here doesn't know their gift yet? Okay, let me tell you what you do. Go home today. Don't talk to nobody. Sit down and have one conversation with yourself. What is the thing that I do the absolute best with the least amount of effort? This ain't going to take you long. You old enough, you grown. Write it down. I don't care if it's networking. I don't care if it's babysitting. I don't care if it's doing color. I don't care if it's painting. Whatever it is, it's what you do. Sing it. Whatever you do the best, write it down. That's your gift. That's it. You ain't got to go asking a bunch of people. They've been telling you your whole life. You know, you ever have people call you with their problems? They always call you with your problems because you gifted at it. But you didn't know how to identify it. If you identify your gift. Now, let me ask you this question. This thing that you're gifted at, if you did it for somebody,
Do you think somebody would pay you $10 for your gift? Just $10. Could you babysit for $10? Could you cut somebody's hair for $10? Could you cut their grass for $10? Could you make them a chicken dinner for $10? Could you do something for $10? Everybody, don't you have something somebody would give you $10 for? Okay, now, once you have something that somebody's willing to pay you $10 for, this is how this works. It's called the multiples of 10. See, you don't have to figure out how to be a millionaire. You just got to figure out the thing that makes you $10. So now here we go. You do it and you make $10. Soon as they pay you the 10, go do it 10 more times. Whatever it was. Watch some more kids 10 more times. Get another 10. You got $100. When you get $100, whatever you did to make that $100, listen to me, do it 10 more times. You ain't got to get tricky with it. Just do it 10 more times. You'd have made $1,000. Whatever you did to make the $1,000, don't get smart. Stay stupid now. Do it 10 more times. You have now made $10,000. Hold up. Now we finna grow a little bit, but guess what you got to do to grow? You just got to do some more. Whatever you made $10,000 doing, I need you to do it 10 more times. What you tripping for? If you do it 10 more times, you got $100,000. Now, you might have to hire some people to make this happen. You got to figure that part out. But all you got to do is do what you did for $10. Once you make $100,000, if you just do it 10 more times.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. Nah, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments.
Let me ask you this.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back, telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. I mean, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't. That nigga hurting himself.
You from New State.
It's over. It's over. All I say is over. Everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it. Let's go across the street.
I ain't called it. I'll slap the fuck out of one of y'all.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical food
foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity, and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield? See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police, like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
Thousands of jobs for local people by Chinese investor Shoe Factory, Huajian Shoe Factory in Ethiopia. Since formal diplomatic ties forged between China and Ethiopia, more than four decades ago, the overall relationship and cooperation between the two countries have grown steadily. Ethiopia has taken China as an example for its economic growth and development. In recent years, the partnership and economic cooperation between the two countries have brought about fruitful outcomes in different sectors, particularly in infrastructure and industrial parks development. The Eastern Industry Zone in the town of Dukem, Oromia Regional State, just 35 kilometers south of the capital Addis Ababa, is one of the mega projects carried out with the Chinese investment in the development of manufacturing sector in Ethiopia. The once farming town began to see a surge in manufacturing in 2010 when Ethiopia's first industrial park was opened here. The Eastern Industry Zone has housed about 85 factories with the Chinese investments and a shoe factory in the industry zone, that is Huajian Shoe Factory, has enabled the country to be a firm on the world exporter map for its Made in Ethiopia shoes.
I'm on the premises of the Eastern Industry Zone in Dukem Town, 35 kilometers south of Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. This is the gate of Huajian Shoe Factory.
Built with Chinese investment, the 40-hectare Eastern Industrial Zone is where Huajian, a Chinese shoemaker producing for brands like Guess, Calvin Klein, Nina and other branded items, set up its factory in 2011. Huajian Shoe Factory, as the Eastern Industry Zone alone, has created job opportunities for about 2,500 local Ethiopians. This was followed by a second Huajian factory in August 2016 in the firm's own industrial park on the outskirts of the capital, Addis Ababa.
You can see the picture of the new Huajian International Light Industry Zone being under construction in Addis Ababa. The Ethio-China Huajian International Light Industry
city invested and constructed by Hojin Group is located in the Labu Lafto district of Addis Ababa, capital of Ethiopia. The functions include such as export processing, trade and service, among others. This integrated industrial park focuses on a light industry and its theme is science and technology, high efficiency, civilization, harmony and environmental friendly. It is the leading area and a demonstration area among the African industrial parks of China's advanced and advantageous industry developing in Africa through One Belt, One Road strategy. The Hojin Light Industry City projected with a total investment of $1 billion, covering a total area of 137.8 hectares with a construction area of 1.5 million square meters, is supposed to be completely constructed in 2020.
We are now inside the Hojin Shu factory, and now I can see that this department is safe. Research and design, and we have workers operating inside an instant.
Here are both male and female workers engaged on their respective duties at this Hojin Shu factory on the premises of the Eastern Industrial Zone. The local workers and the Chinese all work here in harmony and in good spirit. Soon, decorating, segregation, binding, polishing, giving final touch, checking, packing, the different activities carried out here at the different sections and each in its own steps.
This department is now evolving. Now we can see how the decoration is made and processed inside this department. We see the workers are on duty and they are working hard, and we see also that the mold is over there, and we see the mold is here and the stuffs are on duty. I think we see also these shoes are the on the final stage. So this is one of the departments of the Hojin Shoe factory. Also, we see the Chinese staff are working along with local staff. As you can see, this is a sewing machine, so workers are on duty. And the Chinese staff and local staff are working together in harmony. Yes, now this female worker also working on this, how to sew this half process to product, and it goes like that. This is the half process to factory. Now the worker is on duty. Now the worker is pairing the shoe which comes from the different sections. እዚህ ጋር ምን እንደሚሰራው የቀለም ነው የቀለም ነው አዎ ኦኬ now she is a kind of polishing it and to give to the final touch.
The slogans and messages within the facility of the shoe factory tend to encourage and create friendly and sound working atmosphere and spirit.
This very large working space of Hojin Shoe factory, we can see also the slogans that is focused on efficiency, effective work, long-term development and harmonious living are among the slogans in this shoe factory. Now we see the different sections are operating in processing the shoe being manufactured in this Hojin Shoe factory on the premises of the Eastern Industry Zone in Vikamtong.
In addition to creating job opportunities, Hojin has enabled hundreds of local employees to get training opportunities towards enhancing their skills and career capabilities in shoe manufacturing sector. Apart from enhancing their skills and current career, the training in China is believed to help local employees be the future managers of Huajin in their home country. To date, Huajin has selected more than 500 Ethiopian employees for a training of 6 months to 3 years in China. Wendo Sanabara is one of the local employees who have had training opportunities in China.
My name is Wendo Sanabara. My experience is I am already working in Huajin more than 6 years. I am working in Huajin is around 2011, starting Huajin. 2013-2014, I am go to China for 2 year training. After then come back to here. My position is now already I'm production assistant, production manager assistant. Now my company is already making infamous shoes, export for American market. Now my company is already the more than 2,500 workers in here.
We see here the final product of the shoe produced, manufactured here in Huajin Shoe Factory of the Eastern Industry Zone. I see here the female worker is on duty of putting the shoes and finalize the package. Yeah, this is a worker in duty of finalizing the final stage of the shoe products, and they are packing and. So can you tell us what are you doing here in the final stage? Yeah, this is will be exported to foreign market. Yeah, this is the final stage of the shoe factory. Yeah, okay. It says that made in Ethiopia, the shoe produced locally here in Ethiopia by Ethiopians in the Huajin shoe factory of the Chinese. These are the package of the final product of Huajin Shoe Factory. It says made in Ethiopia. Once the shoe products are produced, finalized and packaged, they will be loaded on these trucks and it will be exported to foreign markets.
Following China's experience, Ethiopia now plans to increase the number of its industrial parks to 15 by June 2018 as part of its effort to boost manufacturing and exports. Within the framework of the Belt and Road Initiative, China has also built and financed a $4.2 billion Ethiopia-Djibouti electrified rail line to boost Ethiopia's industrial exports. For the Huajin case, it is an integration of China's technic advantage with Ethiopia's low-cost production advantage, achieving win-win cooperation.
Now we are leaving this room, which is a model of this project, that is Ethiopia-China Huajin International Light Industry Zone, which is underway in Labu, Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa.
Teacher. Segregation, determination, difference. walking around with their heads in the sky. Dead as a babe in the summertime. Control the sound, so shooting rockets to the moon. Kids going up to soon. Politicians say more taxes will solve everything.
And the band played on.
Organizations like the SBA making it easier for you to get into business. But 50 years ago, what do you think the odds would be that you could start your own small business and make it succeed?
The odds were against a black man succeeding in the business world, but John Johnson has never been one to look at the downside. He used $500, perseverance, faith, and family devotion to build an empire worth nearly $200 million. His name is now a legend in the world of publishing, fashion, beauty products, and broadcasting. John Johnson has a formula for taking what seems impossible and making it real. His story is an inspiration for people of all colors.
Well, I guess it just proves in a continuing way that there is opportunity there. That given the knowledge, the devotion, and the sacrifice, that success can come. So it ought to tell us that more young blacks ought to take a chance. I think really that in the past, when young blacks have gone to college, we have assumed that we did not get respect and prestige unless we went into the professions. I think now more and more that is changing. We're recognizing that money and success gives you prestige and recognition, even though it may come from selling hamburgers, it may come from selling barbecue, it may come from opening a grocery store or running a cleaning plant or any other thing. And I think as we move ahead and as those areas, the business area, gets more recognition and more credibility, then I think more young people will go into it. Unfortunately, in the white corporate world as we know it today, there is a ceiling on how far blacks can go. There are rare exceptions, but by and large, the vice presidency is as far as you can go. Now, there are some of us who are not just temperamentally suited to be only vice president. We want to be presidents. We want to run things. We want to be in charge. For those people, I say, you've got to go out and start your own. And so I believe for people who are satisfied to be a vice president, perhaps in the long run, for people who want to work for someone else and to live under the fear now of mergers and buyouts, all of which jeopardize their security, if they want to live that way, fine. But if they really want to have a degree of security, a degree of fulfillment, if they want to make a contribution to the race as a whole, then I think they need to go out and start their own.
If you had to do it all over again today, what type of business would you go into?
If I was starting over again today, and if all the publications were in place that are in place today, I don't think I'd go into the publishing business. I think I'd be inclined to go into the service business, somewhere where you're rendering service. I might want to start my own chain of hamburger places. I still think it's very sad that we don't have barbecue franchises. I think we could develop cleaning establishment franchises. I think anything that would give service to the public would be a good thing to go into now. Because service is no longer important to people. You walk around and people are arrogant. They're insensitive. They don't want to serve. So I'd want to be in something where service would move me ahead.
What advice would you give a small business going after a larger client?
And I developed a simple philosophy. I said that I would call companies and they all want to refer me to the contributions department, and I say, no, I don't want a contribution. I want to give you something in return for your giving me something. I would always say that if the president of the smallest country in the world came to America, our president, as a matter of public policy and protocol, would see that president. And I said to the people, I am the president of a very small company, but I am the president. And I feel that as a matter of courtesy, your president ought to see me. Now, I have to say I was never turned down. I was put aside. I was delayed. But I was never turned down. And persistence went out. I think what you need more than anything else in going into business is persistence, a refusal to give up, a motivation to continue when everything looks like you ought to quit. And I think that's what entrepreneurs have to have.
How important is access to information to the small business person?
There's a great need for information. There are all kinds of people out there who are writing me letters and calling up with good ideas and wanting to know how to go into business. So I think if we had a national television show devoted to business development, it would be a great thing.
Do you all believe as a race, I'm not talking about you specifically, but do you believe as a race, African Americans, we play the victim?
Hey, man.
I have a dream.
No. I'm just going to leave that as a one-word answer. I'm not even going to jump in deeper than that. No.
Yeah, I'm on the side of absolutely not, and I will leave it there until somebody disagrees.
Yeah, then I'll jump back in. And now I'm gonna step back.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm gonna be real. I'm gonna say yes.
Let's go.
I'm gonna say yes.
Give me an example.
See, it's a loaded question just because I'm not going to sit here and say every single African-American size either on the yes side or on the no side.
Mm-hmm.
I say yes to mainly spark conversation, but also I know you're not talking, you said not personal experiences, but that's all I got to go on. I will say, you know, just based on where I am in life, I've gotten a lot of pressure from African-Americans feeling like, you know, I've gotten to where I am because of white people, or you can't speak, you didn't grow up like I did. Like, I came from the hood, you know, I didn't have the same opportunities and privileges that other people had. And though, you know, I believe that to be true, in today's America, I really do feel like anybody has the opportunity to rise to the occasion. Now, is it easier for certain people over others? Yeah. I mean, let's be real. Yes. Like, that's 100% true. But, you know, I just keep hearing, like, systemic oppression, this, that, and the third. Like, yeah, we get it. I know. Like, we all know. Like, we all know. But the opportunities are still there. Will you have to work a little bit harder to get to where you want to be? Absolutely. Because of how you look? Absolutely. I'm a testament of it.
Anybody gonna say nothing?
I want to hear this.
I think it's impossible to accuse us of playing the victim. You're talking about a 400-plus year head start for a particular set of people. You're talking about systematic oppression. That's what I meant by a post-traumatic state. Is we're at this stage in 2020. We're trained to say, yeah, it's unequal, but that's just not okay to me. I don't think we should ever get to the place where we just accept inequality.
Correct.
I'm not encouraging stagnation, so I agree with you. I'm not encouraging throwing in the towel like, yo, it's not fair. That's not what I'm saying at all. But while striving to be your best self, you should never accept inequality. And I think that's what we're being trained to kind of just be like, yo, this is just the way it is, and to no longer call it out. And I'm not even saying we got to go picket, protest. I'm not saying none of that. But at least in conversations like this, if we're not going to set a standard, no standard is going to be set. Nobody else is going to stand it. Nobody else is going to set it. You're talking about, statistically, like factually speaking, at the onset of the 20th century, you're talking about landowners only giving land to specific races. That's generational wealth. Yeah. You're talking about bank loans only being given to specific races.
How can you?
That's generational wealth.
Correct.
So we can't. It's not even like this is ancient history. That's what blows my mind. This is recent history.
But he didn't say that that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
What he said was, do we play the victim?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very different. You're aware of the things that have happened, but are you victimized as a result of it?
So,
do you say, this is what I can do with what I have been allotted or whatever my place in life is? Are we playing the victim is the question.
Well, I think we have to define play the victim.
Okay.
I think we are the victim.
Okay. Because anybody can be a victim.
I think we are factually a victim.
So all races can be victims.
What are we calling playing the victim?
What do you see that as then?
What do I see what as?
Playing the victim, like when you hear that, like what does that trigger for you?
Play the victim means I'm acting like something is being done to me that's not being done
to me.
Or always
complaining. Always complaining about our history.
That's what I hear when I hear play the victim. Like you're taking the position that something being done to you and nothing's being done to you. That's somebody playing a victim to me.
This is what I hear.
And that's not the case to me.
This is what I hear.
Yeah.
Get over slavery. Stop talking about it. We're all equal now. You should be ahead. You should be further than where you're at. Stop talking about the old days. I'm gonna stop right there. That's what it triggers in my head.
Mm-hmm. So, to say like you can't, I don't think you can outrule or like just say, hey, some black people aren't playing the victim because everyone uses excuses.
Correct.
And people can be playing the victim by whatever excuse they may bring. But like you said, like. We weren't given an opportunity basically to build that generational wealth. And without that opportunity, we don't own anything. So we are having to kind of look for employment like at wherever you work. And even you said there's one person at D1 that's black. And we're 15% of the nation. That's not an accurate representation of America. So therefore, we may not be playing the victim, but we're getting hurt. In corporate America or whatever part of life. That's kind of just statistics.
I'm going to agree with him. I also don't like the term playing the victim because it does sound like you're alluding to something that is not real.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we, I'm not dismissing or negating the effects of 400 years of oppression.
Sure.
And, you know, the things that we've seen and been through. I'm not dismissing any of that. But if we cut it all off and we started with a year ago, we are still being victimized by the stuff you have to see on TV. You have African-American boys who at the age of 11 or 12, all they have ever seen were African-American boys being killed on TV. Mm-hmm. That's all they've ever seen. They've not known the life without it because they've watched this happen since they've been old enough to understand. Mm-hmm. They are victims. You can go into a grocery store. You can go into an amusement park. You can go anywhere and be mistreated, and you will be a victim today. We're not talking about the victimization only of the yesteryears. You can be a victim tomorrow. And I think if we're all honest, we have been in places where you have been the victim.
That's right.
You were either wrongly accused or wrongly criticized, or maybe let's not even make it a negative thing. Looked over for a job unjustly. It's happening. So there's a rationale to the relevancy of still being victimized.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like I was, to her point, it's not even like this is ancient history. We're talking about 1960s, 1970s, like the Civil Rights Act was just passed halfway through the 20th century. Like, it's not even hundreds of years ago. Like, there are people alive still, like, you know what I mean, who went through segregation that are still alive. Like, it's not even,
of course.
You know what I mean? It's not even ancient history. So I can never agree that the responsibility is on us to fix the mistakes of others. I could never agree with that. I just can't.
And it doesn't take away, you know, something that I said on the back end of my last answer. At some point, as a family, as a community, you can gather the people you love and say, let's get us out of this.
Correct.
And then you could say, well, we're no longer playing the victim. We took pride and took our own responsibility. And then you can build all that up, and tomorrow you can go somewhere and still be disrespected.
To that point, in my initial answer to you, I said I'm not making an excuse for stagnation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not no excuse to be stagnant.
Yeah.
It's not no excuse to not grind and hustle and get out here and get it. But even if his question is about us as a race and as a culture,
mm-hmm.
and if I get my family together and pull my family up, that's my family.
Exactly.
You feel me?
That's
not balancing the scales.
That's right.
You know
and
what I'm saying?
It's very interesting. Your point is very, very interesting because I could be an extremely successful black man in today's America and still go somewhere tomorrow and be looked down upon because of what I look like.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you, because I remember like Booker T. Wash in like the 1890s to like kind of offset the Jim Crow laws. He was
not
like,
saying
hey,
I'm that old, right? You're not trying to give me just some
you remember
cool.
him, right?
Yeah. I didn't go. Make sure you know I didn't go fool. All right, brother. I'm the historian.
He said basically.
Is my gray showing that much, though, for real?
No, I was going to ask you this. So you said basically to offset the Jim Crow laws that were put in place, we had to educate and be entrepreneurs. And you two have both done that.
Yeah.
So I'd like to hear your experience because this is, 130 years later from him saying, hey, we need to mobilize on our own, get education, and be entrepreneurs. And that will create our own system of wealth. But, I mean, you're only, like you said, you're only one person. It's hard to pull up a whole group.
Of course.
So I'd kind of like to hear y'all's experience as being entrepreneurs.
You can talk me in the office.
I was going to let you go first.
Simone owns her own shop, too, so I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Oh, okay.
I'm taking it in.
I'm sorry.
I'm listening right now.
Well, like I said, I was kind of raised in an entrepreneurial family, right? I was always taught, don't work. I'll just be honest, my father, don't work for the white man. That was it, right? You get education, anything you can take, put it towards your own business. Put your own 2 feet on the ground. Save your money. You know, get a hustle. You know, he's showing me all these things to do. So it was always in my mind that I had to work for myself. The only way I'm going to come up is to work for myself. So I was never trained to, you know, you're going to get a great education, then you're going to go get a great job, and then you're going to be successful, then you're going to raise a family. That was out. Go get your own brand. Raise your family. Give your brand to your family. Mm. Let them continue that generational wealth. So that's the way I was taught.
Mm.
And that's the way I got to keep it moving.
So give me rephrase the question that you had specifically.
Basically, what I was saying is Booker T. Washington said to offset any type of segregation or discrimination or from playing the victim, we need to educate and be entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
Has that experience kind of helped you push through, and have you been able to bring others up because of your entrepreneurship?
Okay, so thank you for that question. I definitely believe that entrepreneurship is freedom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's ultimate freedom. I was writing down a thought just yesterday as I was flying through Chicago. that one sign of enslavement is a name change. That when people say that you're something, that you're not. So if I was to like go and address the same idea with biblical characters, we could look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Mm-hmm.
That was not their name.
Yes.
It was their name that they were given in enslavement. And I can just imagine how they were in a room together and, you know, one of them yelled, "Hey, Shadrach, dude, that is not my name. I'm Toby." you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And feel like we have a responsibility to know who we are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have a responsibility to do our due diligence to make our name great. That somebody can walk around and call you a liar. Is that who you are?
Yeah.
That's not who you are. Somebody can walk around and call you a thief. Is that who you are? That's the name that the enslavement has given you, right? And so I think that the only way that we can exercise true freedom is in ownership of our stuff, of ourselves, of our actions, of the things that we create, that we can be makers. I think that this is the time for all hustlers to unite, you know, that we all can make whatever we want to be a part of. We no longer have to sit back and say, oh, it's because of what you did to me. Listen, I was molested as a child. So if we want to go back and talk about victimization of the things that people have done to us, we can do that. Or we can rise above it and we can say, well, this is who I am now. This is what I'm going to do. When I started my business, I could not bake, not even out of a box. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any credit. I didn't have any experience in the business. Nobody was going to give me a loan for anything. I was losing the house that the very bakery exists in right now, 11 years later. Because when you put your mind, this is what I was saying earlier, we can be focused on what happened for us instead of what has happened to us. I believe that it is that blood running through my veins that had things taken from her. You know, it is that blood running through my veins.
Do you all believe as a race, I'm not talking about you specifically, but do you believe as a race, African Americans, we play the victim?
Hey, man.
I have a dream.
Hello, no sound again, no sound.
Black America is potentially the most dangerous group of humans alive today. Dangerous to who? Dangerous to the corporate empire, Illuminati, imperial scum, whatever you want to call them, white supremacists.
White supremacy is the problem. You just happen to be white.
How much of the problems in the black community are the blacks' own fault?
Well, white supremacy is the main problem in our community. If we
How much of the problems are your own
if we,
fault?
Excuse me, if we resolve white supremacy...
Okay, I have to call into my own show as a guest. 407, can you hear me now? 407?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. Your comment or question or contribution?
When I heard the brother say, I can be the most successful person in my business or my community and then go into another location or area and be treated poorly or disrespectfully, I thought about, we are the generation to dispel ignorance because, Yeah, you could go anywhere and see meet ignorance, and that's what racism is ignorance. So everywhere you go, you're going to have the possibility or the opportunity. You know, there's one, you can be the victim and say, oh, look what happened to me. These people don't like me. But here's an opportunity for you to share your knowledge, education. We're a lot more educated this generation, all generations. We got phones, everything. So we're a lot more educated. We have more knowledge and experience if you've traveled. So why not use that experience, education, to educate ignorant white folks or black folks? Black folks are racist, too. You know, it's like it doesn't just go one way. So I just thought about, yeah, if you're successful and you meet ignorance, what do you do about it? You're going to be, oh, poor me. You don't like me. You're a victor now. You have education. You're successful. Racism shouldn't offend you or bother you. There are ignorant people out there. So let's dispel it. Let's get rid of the ignorance by educating people who treat you differently because of your skin, if that's the case. I went to a tiny house community yesterday, and I met a black woman who has not only a tiny house there, but she has a mobile home that's been parked there for many years, and they're trying to get rid of the mobile homes and trailers. But she was all talking about how racist some people are because they stopped her in this tiny house park, and they're like, you live here? Oh, they were surprised to see a black woman in a tiny house community. And it is kind of rare, but it's happening. And she right away went to white supremacy and capitalism and all that as the reason why some people, she was treated differently as a dark-skinned woman. And I thought, you know, yeah, I said, well, have you just thought about they're just ignorant? And, you know, you have to just approach ignorant people a different way when you're having a conversation. So that's my take on that, what we just heard, is that, yeah, there's people who are still in victim mode because maybe they don't know how to take advantage of opportunities to educate people about their own history, our history in America, and how we need to come against the ignorance that is still prevalent. It's not a lot. I don't meet that every day like some people say they do, but maybe because I don't have a chip on my shoulder about that. I'm ready to educate people the minute they come at me in a way that I feel is disrespectful or ignorant or any of negativity. If it comes my way, I have to bring education and positivity. So I want to challenge everybody to kind of rise up out of victimhood and just start educating whoever you meet that demonstrates their level of low education. Thank you, Ella.
Okay, I got a question for you now. Here's a headline that's trending. A Trump-backed Senate candidate says gun violence. Well, hold on. Let's see what it is. Well, he's saying gun violence is basically due to, well, no, let me read it correctly. He's blaming gun violence on black folks. Your thoughts? The headline reads specifically, Trump-backed Senate candidate says gun violence is black people, frankly. Blake Masters, a Republican candidate for the United States Senate in Arizona, who is backed by former President Donald Trump, claims gun violence is largely a racial issue. We have a gun violence problem in this country, and it's gang violence. Masters told Jeff Aravitz's show, a podcast in April, and his comments were spotted this week by the Daily Beast. It's people in Chicago, St. Louis, shooting each other. Very often, you know, black people, frankly, Master said, and the Democrats don't want to do anything about it. So, just weeks after his comments, 10 black shoppers were murdered in a mass shooting in Buffalo, New York. The suspect, who was white, allegedly targeted black people during his killing spree. He also reportedly is a believer in replacement theory, a conspiracy theory that has spread and conservative media circles such as Fox News. Anyway, thoughts on this senator or politician running for a Senate seat?
That's a valid, true point. You got more black people killing other black people than anything else. My guest last night pointed out that 75% of gun violence is suicide. I'm like, what? What? And I'm like, okay, I got to look that up. That's a statistics we should all be looking at. 75% of guns are used for suicide. And there's a book he mentioned called More Guns, Less Crime. And so we are being fed a lot of misinformation by the media and all the propaganda that we're seeing around mass shootings is blowing out of proportion the truth that, okay, more people killing themselves with guns. And the truth is there's probably been more black people killing each other than any mass shootings. When you think about it, look at all the violence that takes place in Chicago every week.
Now, Chicago's a city.
Who's holding those guns? Hey?
Oh, Chicago's a city. But if you look at the map of the United States, the overwhelming blacks only found in a handful of places in the United States. Chicago happens to be one of them. You go to Montana, Idaho, majority of Washington State, Alaska, Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, Kentucky, Ohio, even Florida. Once you get outside of Miami, Orlando, Tampa, maybe Tallahassee and Jacksonville, because Florida's got 6 or 7 counties. Florida's basically a lily white state. Other than the Latinos in South Florida.
Well, I'm just, yeah, okay, those are interesting statistics. But again, back to the guy's point, black people are killing each other, probably in bigger numbers than mass shootings.
Well, in Chicago, Chicago, New York, L.A., D.C., those places.
So his statement has some truth to it. It has some truth. Black people are killing each other with guns. So what are you talking about? We have a gun problem. Yeah, we have a gun problem in the black community. These mass shootings are all planned. When you listen to my guest last night, they plan these things according to the numbers and the masonry and all the MK Ultra. These things are planned to program people's minds into fear. And push the agenda to take away the guns take away the guns in the black community. How do people get those guns? Probably on the black market. A lot of those guns probably not even bought. Underground market.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
Yeah, we're getting the truth about all this gun violence at all.
We'll get more on that tomorrow because Law Talk, I had to call in like you did because the switchboard, I don't know, is tripped out. So let me make this quick announcement. Viata's Tiny House, Viata's Tiny House Village. Tell us about that real quick, and how can we view it?
Well, so our new YouTube channel, LA and I are working on, are producing to bring, it's a YouTube channel, so go to Viata's Tiny House Village, and we're putting up videos so far on a daily basis to educate people, inspire people, and motivate people to live simpler lives, smaller lives, and minimalize and declutter their lives. That's the focus of this channel. So tune in to that for information and to help educate people on how to build.